to the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. I'm Chair Senator Suzanne Bonamici. I apologize for the late start this morning. We were trying to work on a technical difficulty with one of the presentations this morning. I would like to start just by having the committee members introduce themselves for the people here today who are in the hearing room and also those watching on the Oregon Channel or video stream. So, Senator Gerard, would you like to start?
Sure. Senator Fred Gerard, I reside in the state and Mill City area.
And I'm Senator Diane Rosenbaum. I represent District 21, which is Southeast Portland, where I live, Northeast Portland, which is close by, and as far south as Milwaukee in Clackamas County.
I'm Larry George from Sherwood and represent Washington, Clackamas, Yamhill, and Marion counties.
And Cheyenne, would you like to introduce yourself?
Please? Certainly, Madam Chair. I'm Cheyenne Ross, the staff.
Thank you. And I believe Senator Burdick will be joining us. So the first item on our agenda, I'd like to open an informational meeting on the issue of tenants in foreclosure. And we have Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center. And I apologize, John Van Landingham is not here this morning. So Christina Dirks, I believe also from the Oregon Law Center, will be joining Sybil. And before we begin, Senator Burdick, would you like to introduce yourself this morning and say where you're from? We're just getting started.
Oh, thank you. Sorry I'm late. I'm Judy Burdick, Senate District 18, Southwest Portland. Tigard and King City.
Thank you. Welcome. And we're going to ask Sybil Hebb and Christina Dirks to give this presentation on tenants in foreclosure, but I want to make it clear that we understand and appreciate that there are foreclosure issues that affect people who aren't tenants, both those in residential homes, also in manufactured home parks. But what we're focusing on this morning is the issue of what happens to tenants in foreclosure. And just as a bit of background, we had a bill in 2009, and we made some adjustments to that in February of 2010, dealing with the rights of tenants in foreclosure. And since that time, there have been changes made in federal legislation that are protective of tenants as well. And so Sybil and Christina are going to tell us about some legislation that we are working on for the next session to strengthen those provisions in our state law and also to make them consistent with the federal law. So welcome.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and very much appreciate the work that this committee has done on this issue in the past, and appreciate your time today to talk about the issue. As the chair mentioned, since this legislature passed laws in 2009 and then in 2010, there have been changes at the federal level that impact what the applicable law is when a tenant is living in a home that is being foreclosed on because of a landlord's default on a mortgage. The Law Center, as you know, represents low-income people. Many of our clients are tenants who are in these circumstances, and we've become aware over the years as the foreclosure crisis has expanded here of the nature of the issues that face tenants in these situations. And so we're primarily concerned about making sure that tenants understand what's going on and what their rights are and that they have enough notice and stability through this process that they can make decisions about how to ensure their housing stability for themselves and their families. As the Senator mentioned, the state law that we passed and that you passed in 2009 provided some specific protections for tenants after the sale of a foreclosure, the sale of a home in foreclosure. And that state law provided that tenants living in month-to-month tenancies, according to month rental agreements, would have 30 days notice after the foreclosure sale. Tenants in fixed-term leases, according to the state law, would have 60 days notice after a foreclosure sale before they could move. The federal law passed provides much greater notice periods for those tenants living in homes that are being sold in foreclosure. The federal law provides 90 days notice after the foreclosure sale and allows the tenant to stay for the full length of a fixed-term lease. And so that's much greater protection for tenants than is provided in our state law. As you know, federal law trumps state law, and so that is the applicable law here in Oregon right now. There are some confusions about that because the notice provisions that we passed in 2009 give information about the state law, refer to the federal law, but I think it's confusing for people trying to apply the law and trying to read the notice when they're served with it to understand what their actual current rights are. And so we'd like to prongs of the effort that we'd like to make this session, and one is to resolve some inconsistencies and confusion, and the other is to expand on the rights to make sure that there's greater protection for tenants. I have a summary of the issues that we would like to address that I hope is in your folder, and I'll go through them briefly, and then I'll just give an overview, and then Christina and I can answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you.
In general, we'd like to resolve the inconsistency with respect to the notice that's provided to tenants after a foreclosure sale so that Oregon law reflects the amount of protection that's provided under federal law. So it would be 90 days notice for a month-to-month lease or rental agreement and the full length of a fixed-term lease. There's also a piece that needs resolution with respect to the definition of who is a covered tenant. In our state discussions last session, we talked about the concept of a good faith tenant. The federal law talks about the concept of a bona fide tenant. They're meant to get at the same kind of concept and to provide some specific clarity about who is a deserving tenant of protection. The definitions are inconsistent. They ought to be the same, and the federal definition, since it is the one that applies now until 2014 when the federal law is due to sunset, we'd like to adopt that definition into the state law so that that's the continuing definition as we apply Oregon's protections. The bona fide definition gets at making sure that the tenant asking for protection is not the child or the husband or wife or the parent of the mortgagor. So it's not a mortgagor trying to extend protection to his family and keep his own ability to stay in the home inappropriately. It's getting at an arm's length transaction between a person who owned the home and a person who was going to become a tenant according to a rental agreement who's not related to the mortgagor, and there needs to be fair market value as a result of the agreement for rent, and agreement needs to have been signed prior to the foreclosure sale itself. The other piece that is worth noting in terms of who is a qualifying and covered tenant has to do with what burden exists for the tenant to get protection. Under the state law, we imposed a burden on the tenant after they receive a notice of foreclosure to provide written evidence of their rental agreement and to send that to the trustee within 30 days prior to the foreclosure sale date. That's become a problem. That requirement doesn't exist in the federal law. That burden is not imposed on the tenant under the federal law, so that's not the applicable law here in Oregon now because of the federal preemption. And we'd like to remove that requirement in the state law as it continues past 2014 because it's confusing for tenants. They get a date, an address, and a date of a foreclosure sale. Often the foreclosure sale is bumped a number of different times or renegotiated as the parties go through attempts to modify or other negotiations. And so the tenant is confused legitimately about when their deadline is, and so they miss it. And it seems that they deserve protection because they're in a rental agreement that was bona fide and that was an arm's length transaction, and they were paying their rent. They should get the protection of the law regardless of whether they trip up over providing that evidence within a certain time frame. So we'd like to remove that protection. The memo that I have lists some examples of other states that have taken steps to impart these protections into their state laws. For the committee's information, I'd be happy to clarify on some of those if you have questions. But I'll move on to our next issue. After the inconsistencies are resolved, the next most important piece for us is to ensure that there are some remedies for circumstances in which the law is not complied with. The law has been in effect since 2009. We're seeing a lot of circumstances where it's not being complied with and tenants are not receiving the protection that we think that they need. We want to make sure that there are ways that a tenant can pursue a remedy in that circumstance. And so neither the state nor the federal law provide any kind of enforcement or remedy mechanism. We propose to allow tenants to have a defense against an eviction proceeding if they weren't provided the appropriate notice, and to make sure that those eviction proceedings are tied into the current landlord-tenant proceedings, which allow for attorney's fees in those circumstances. We also would like to provide statutory damages for a violation of the notice provisions, and to ensure that in the eviction process, a lender seeking to evict a tenant after a foreclosure provides the proof of the notice that they're required to show under the statute, so that the judge, in looking at the case, can determine whether or not the requirements have been met easily. So those are the three practical proposals that we have that we'd like to consider with respect to enforcement. The other piece that we're interested in is looking at requiring a notice of change in ownership after the foreclosure sale. As you might imagine, since the foreclosure sale date is often changed, and sometimes the tenant does not get notice of that change in date, the tenant can be confused as to whether the sale has taken place or not. Often these sales take place on the courthouse steps. The tenant, you know, may be 30 miles from the courthouse, may not have any knowledge that this is happening, and can often be confused about who is the owner of the home and whether they still have a relationship with their landlord or not. So providing a notice of the change in ownership after the foreclosure sale has taken place can be a simple notice that just indicates this is the sale date, ownership has changed, here's the new owner. It's also an opportunity to provide the tenant with some information about what their rights are at that stage so that they understand the sale's taken place, there is a new owner, but they have some protection, some stability before they're required to move. And so we would propose inserting that requirement. And again, several states have taken steps to address that issue as well. Just three more issues I wanted to mention, and one is related to the practical application of the eviction process. So when a lender has purchased, or when a new purchaser may not have been the lender, has purchased a home after a foreclosure sale, the state statute now, thanks to efforts in 2009, provides that the process by which they remove that person should be through the federal, the eviction process, the FED process that's set up for normal landlord-tenant proceedings. It's quick, it's efficient, it protects due process of both sides, and we took the step, you took the step last session to say that that's the process that should be used to evict a tenant after a new purchaser owns the home. We want to specify that that's the only process that can be used. The statute's a little bit ambiguous about whether there might be other procedures that could be used, and we think this is the appropriate one. So we want to clarify that. And we'd also like to take the counterpart step of amending the FED forms. Those forms are provided by statute. They're the forms that everyone uses in an eviction process. They have check boxes where the plaintiff, the person who's suing for eviction, gets to check what their grounds are for eviction. There is no box to check to say that you are a lender after a foreclosure sale evicting a tenant on a 90-day notice. And so that would be a simple change to the forms that I think would go a great way towards educating the parties as well as the court as to what the process is. So we'd like to take those practical steps as well. And as sort of a counterpart to that, there's some other pieces related to the Landlord-Tenant Act that we think ought to be applicable to lenders and tenants after a foreclosure sale. As you may remember, the purchasers and the lender community wanted to make sure that there was clarity about their ability not to become a landlord after a foreclosure sale. And so we codified in this statute, which is a protection that exists in Oregon statute that does not exist under the federal law, to say that lenders after a foreclosure sale only become landlords in certain circumstances. So they basically have the choice to determine whether or not they want a landlord-tenant relationship or they want to avoid that and thus avoid the responsibilities of repairs and habitability maintenance, et cetera. Tenants are very nervous about that. Our community was very nervous about that because, of course, we don't want tenants living in homes that are unmaintained. But we think that the legislature struck a fair balance last session in figuring in allowing the lenders to become landlords in some circumstances and not in others. And So we exempted new purchasers from many of the provisions, most of the provisions of Chapter 90, which is the landlord-tenant chapter. And that, we think, is appropriate with a few exceptions. There are some pieces that we think would be good for both lenders, new purchasers, as well as tenants to be incorporated into this relationship, even though new purchasers are not becoming landlords. Just to give you a couple of examples, and then I'll be quiet. There is a provision in the Landlord-Tenant Act that addresses what happens when a tenant moves out of a home and there is property abandoned in the home. So the tenant may have a relationship or a need for some of that property. They simply weren't able to get it out in time. The lender may want legitimately to dispose of the property but is afraid of a lawsuit. And so the statute in the Landlord-Tenant Act allows for a consistent and reasonable process by which both parties know what their rights are in that circumstance. And the landlord is allowed to sell and dispose of that property after a certain period and to charge the tenant for those costs. The tenant has some notice of that process so that they can object and have a chance to get their property back, and it sort of protects both parties. That's one example. There are a few other provisions in the Landlord-Tenant Act that we think ought to be incorporated into this relationship as well, and so we expect to bring that forward in our bill. And one other small piece has to do with maintenance of utilities while a foreclosure is pending. And I'll just flag this issue briefly. We expect that this particular issue will be addressed in a separate bill, because the more we learned about it, the more we learned that tenants often have trouble maintaining their utilities when a landlord is in foreclosure because the landlord may not be paying the utility bill. But that circumstance happens outside of a foreclosure as well. And the circumstance that comes up for us is when a tenant is paying rent to a landlord, that rent includes utilities, and the landlord is promising then basically to provide the electric and the light and the water in receipt of rent. And if the landlord gets in default of those payments to the utility, currently the utility's remedy is to shut the service off to the tenant, to the service address. And that's then depriving the tenant of that service, which the tenant has essentially paid for in the rent to the landlord. Some states have taken steps, and we'd like to consider steps that would allow the tenant to get advance notice if that shutoff is pending, so that they can then have the right to pay the utility and then offset that payment against the rent that they owe to the landlord. We're looking at finding a way that's fair and reasonable to allow the utility to get paid, the tenants to keep their service on so they don't lose their lights or their hot water in the middle of the winter, and then the tenants can get paid back via the rent from the landlord. We expect that issue will actually be addressed in a separate bill, because it is broader than just a foreclosure circumstance. So thanks for your attention and your time. And Christine and I would be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you so much for your very thorough testimony. I'm going to start with a question, and I'll preface that by saying that representatives of the financial industry were invited to testify, and also landlords, and declined, wanted to just listen today. But maybe, Sybil, if you could tell us a little bit about with whom you've discussed these issues and who's been involved in coming up with these proposals. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. We're doing our best to reach out to all of the interested parties and are continuing to identify who those may be and maintaining our list. But thus far, we've spoken with the Bankers Association and also with Jim and Matt Marquis and Paul Cosgrove, and we've also spoken to the credit unions. Now, they haven't seen a draft. We don't have a draft yet that is finalized. We've shared this outline with them and sat down to have meetings with them, and so we're soliciting feedback as we go along. We've also reached out to, and I'll forgive me if I'm forgetting to mention anyone in the back who I've spoken with, but we've also spoken with Pacific Power, Pacific, what's the name of the Pacific Utility?
Pacific Core?
Thank you. Pacific Core. It's embarrassing. Thank you. I'm starting to get them mixed up. With Pacific Core, also with PG&E and Northwest Natural Gas, and we've spoken with the electric co-ops, as well as Mark Landauer from the municipal utilities and the City of Portland. And so we still have work to do and appointments that we're setting for the future, but we're doing our best to get as much feedback as we can. We have an appointment this afternoon to talk with landlord representatives as well.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Dredd.
Oh, thank you. I just need a point of clarification, and my memory kind of jogged a little bit. When we define tenant, can that be a corporation, and does these laws impact commercial properties?
Senator Dredd, members of the committee, that's a great question. They do not cover anything other than residential tenants. And so the circumstances, and the bill is drafted very specifically in Oregon to cover buildings where a tenant who is covered by the Chapter 90 Residential Landlord-Tenant Act is residing or may be residing. So I hope that answers your question.
Any other questions?
I do have one, but I apologize that I missed the middle of your presentation because I was called out by the presiding officer's office, so go figure. But on the maintenance of utilities issue, and this really is, I think, beyond the scope of your proposal, but some other states have laws that prohibit people's source of heat, for instance, or light from being shut off during winter periods. Are you aware, does Oregon have any protections like that?
Senator Rosenbaum, members of the committee, yes, Oregon does have protections like that. Those protections, as far as I'm aware, apply to customers of the utility and not to tenants who are paying the customer of the utility. So and I'm not aware if there are states that have those sorts of protections that apply to recipients of service who are not actually customers. Does that make sense? The protections apply now if the person who's paying the bill for the utility is the person who has the medical emergency or who is in need of assistance that the state has determined qualifies them to be protected from a utility shutoff. There may be others in the room who are more familiar with this set of protections, but to my knowledge, none of those protections in Oregon apply to
renters.
Renters, correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
No, thank you very much. I think that means that your presentation was very thorough.
Thank you very much for your
thank
attention.
Thank you for your testimony.
Okay, next on our agenda, we have Karen Garst. And Karen was originally on our agenda for February to talk about free trial offers, but unfortunately we were called to the Senate floor and we had to cancel sort of at the last minute, Ms. Garst. So we invited her to come back today and give her presentation on free trial offers. And I believe we have this set up now. With fingers crossed.
Well, let me introduce myself, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen Garst. I reside in Sherwood and I'm a constituent of Senator George. I recently retired, actually a year and a half ago, as director of the Oregon State Bar. I'm now serving as part-time secretary for my son, which keeps me busy. And he is this year he's a sophomore at the University of Arizona in Tucson. There we go.
And the committee members also have the presentation, a copy of the presentation here.
I wanted to do this in a PowerPoint so you could actually see some of the websites and how people are drawn into this. Okay. Do I just press the buttons?
And here we go.
Okay, here's
the victim.
This is my son, Samuel Dakota Garst. And you can see by his smile that that's a key feature there, and it's important to protect. So when he saw tooth whitening cheaply on the web, that was certainly the place to go. What happens here is there's generally a neutral review, and you look at Web for Health. Well, that must be legitimate. It's like Consumer Reports. Of course, it's not. It's part of the advertising. But you're drawn into that. And then very often they use these symbols and it leads you and gives you the impression that this is endorsed. Now, there are some lawsuits going on. Oprah Winfrey, I understand, has filed a lawsuit against some of these companies for using her name. But it gives legitimacy to the product. And then there's obviously targeting young people, a very active first web page to draw you in. And look at all these people who are using Premium White. There's a number of names for this, so if I go back and forth, it's because there's a plethora of products out there. And then just so you act immediately, you know, get into this now. There aren't very many left. Be one of the first. Don't lose out. Rush my order, etc. And of course, you qualify, which is just, of course, amazing. Everyone qualifies for the trial, obviously. Now, all so far, you've seen trial. You haven't seen that there's a cost to this. It's just a free trial. And some of these you will see at the very, very, very bottom in small print, the details. No one's looking at that. They're looking at congratulations. All I have to do is send in $4.95 for my shipping, and I'll get the product, and I can try it out and see if I like it. Well, what does the fine... that's not the next one. Okay. Well, that's not exactly the right one. Some of these people even have the nerve to say we're the good guys and not the bad guys. And watch out for bogus teeth whitening claims, and then they do exactly that. This is the specific page that my son ordered from. It's called Dazzle Smile. Congratulations, you've qualified for the trial. In the small print at the very top is the qualifications. And basically what it says is, if you keep the trial, we're going to charge your credit card $87 every single month. And you have 14 days to cancel. Nobody is reading that. It's totally unreasonable. And, by the way, you're also going to get a trial subscription to World Club Fitness. Well, for heaven's sakes, that's not even on the page. And yet that's tucked into it as you're also going to get that, and we're going to bill you $24 for that. Well, all everyone sees is this $4.95 for shipping. They see none of this. So at 11 o'clock one night, I got a call from my son saying, I was sound asleep, Mom, I got a credit card charge for $79, and I have no idea what it's for. And I said immediately, you think I can do anything about that at 11 o'clock at night? And you'll see that there's this check card, Easy Beauty. It doesn't say Dazzle Smile, which might have triggered something in him that I did order Dazzle Smile, but it's a totally different name. He called it. He got absolutely no response. So I said, they messed with the wrong kid's mom, and said I would work on it. So the next day I called the Wells Fargo, and basically they said, gee, was there a smaller charge earlier by the same company? And that really helped trigger his memory about Dazzle Smile, so we were able to figure it out. It was this tooth whitening product. But that was a discovery in and of itself. And so Mom, the secretary, got online, Dazzle Smile. I didn't see a number. I did this web chat, and I thought it was really interesting that I could print out the exact chat I had with this person. I think they slipped up there. And basically what they did is obfuscate. Are you sure? I don't have his address. I don't have his name. I don't have his credit card. And I just had to keep on insisting, yes, yes, you're the one, yes, please find it, please look again. And finally, the service rep agreed to cancel the trial. I said, well, that's good. That's step one. Now I want my money back. I want the $79 refunded. Oh, we can't do that. You'll have to call customer service. That's something totally, I can't do that. So the means by which they secured the credit card, internet, is not by the means by which you can get a credit refund, which is something I think the FDA is working on as well. So then I called customer service. I finally got through to them. Well, we can't refund the money because the small print, of course, says that after 14 days. And I said, let me speak to your supervisor, talk to the supervisor. Obviously, you can see I don't give up easily. They agreed to refund the product if it was returned. And the person on the line says, gee, it'd probably really be a good idea if you got a tracking number, which leads me to believe they know what game they're playing. Several weeks later, I didn't get a refund. I called customer service. They denied receiving the product.
Can I interrupt with a question before?
Yes.
Did your son send back the Dazzle White stuff? Okay, so he sent it back.
We sent it back. Okay. This occurred several weeks after we sent it back. and they denied getting the product. So I had to call Sam back, got the tracking number, called back, and they said, well, we haven't gotten it. And I said, here's the tracking number. Oh, I guess we do have it. So you can see this takes a lot of attention and persistence to get through this maze. They've been trained all along to say, no, 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 we don't have it. 99% of the people, number one, wouldn't have noticed on their credit card. They could. Some of these people go months before they notice it and rack up hundreds of dollars of charges. He fortunately noticed it the first time, but you can see what it takes and what, to be persistent. Now, I started out with, I'll get his money back, trust me. But most people aren't like that. They're going to give up, particularly if there's only one charge and they get the trial canceled. They'll probably feel that they have achieved something great and give up. Not me. So they finally acknowledged they'd gotten the product, but the supervisor said, I can't refund it. My computer's not working. I can't push the credit through. So even when I had a commitment from them to return the money, they did not do it. So what I did then is turn back to Wells Fargo, which was just, they were very helpful during this process, alerting us that it was Dazzle Smile, helping us, and they agreed to refund the credit card. But, of course, I didn't stop there. I filed a complaint with the Attorney General in Oregon. They were very good. They communicated well with me. They contacted the company. The lawyer in New York said, well, the refund was made on November 9th. Of course, they never did make a refund. So I filed a disciplinary complaint against him with the New York State Bar. He's no longer representing the company. It was the first complaint he'd ever had. Sorry about that. But other actions taken, I wrote to every state, each consumer protection division of all the states' attorneys general. I'll put it in your file probably 80% of the time. I did make contact and have continued to contact, communicate with a person from Utah. I've had some success. Arizona's had some success. I filed a written complaint with the FTC. I wrote our congressional delegation, Representative Congressman Kurt Schrader, I'm sorry. Laughs there. Did write the FTC, and they kind of wrote back and said, have her file a complaint. Well, I've already done that. And I think the chair of the committee, if not somebody else, saw the story on KGW. They had done a story about free trials, and I contacted Ann Yeager, KGW, and then they did a story and televised it on their channel. Who's behind this? One of the principal players, his name is Jesse Wilms, and I know that's an odd spelling, called Just Think Media. And Alberta gives him company an F. What he does, and it's a little complicated, he has these affiliates, and what they do is they work with advertisers to push people to somebody's website or push people to buy a product. And some of these people who are selling this product are small entrepreneurs, and what happens is their business increases like a thousandfold. They have Dazzle Smile in Alberta. I didn't even list them all. 52 websites associated with his company. And once something happens like Dazzle Smile, they just take it off. And they're very clever about, they know when you get on the web what your ISP address is, so they will say, a Beaverton mom endorses the product. They make everything localized. They do that electronically. But they're basically driving and working to get this product. And, you know, they don't really care whether somebody continues and has it for multiple months because they're making so much money on month one and month two. Even if they canceled everybody's trial after month one and month two, they would still be making millions and millions of dollars. The easiest thing to do would be to make these negative opt-outs illegal. I don't know. I understand you have a work group. I don't know how far it's progressing. FTC has proposed some changes. I think that at the very least, there should be some, and the FTC is working on this, some affirmative consent to continue the trial. so that if you have a free trial and you advertise a free trial, it is a free trial. And they can't hook you in by the credit card that you charge for the shipping and handling. So that you would have to sign up, affirmatively say, I want to continue to receive the product. I understand it's $79. But this is a lot like the 60s where people started to sign up for a record company. I told my sister about this, and she told me all her travails in the 60s of trying to get out of Columbia Record Company and how difficult that was. But something needs to be done because people are caught unawares. People do not check their credit card statements or their bank statements. It goes for several months. They're out money. They might be able to stop the trial. They might be able to do a stop on their checking account or their credit card so it stops it. But they rarely get their money back. I was more successful. I got the money back. I actually got it back twice because Wells Fargo credited, and then when I found the lawyer in New York and told him that the company had never credited, they gave me that too. But I'm sure I'm rare. I would be happy to answer any questions. I would be happy to work with your work group. I think this is something that needs some work by the legislature to avoid this deceptive practice on consumers. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I'm going to open it up to questions.
Well, Madam Chair, just an observation. These are real scumbags, but you almost make me feel sorry for these weasels. you really pursued it, and I want to commend you for that. You probably did a lot of good there.
Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Karen, thank you for a really thorough presentation, and your son is certainly lucky to have you, and as are, I guess, consumers in the state of Oregon. But I'm looking at your slide that says, what does the fine print say, that then blows up the fine print? And I don't get, in the offer details, it says in bold letters, cancel any time. How can this company then be arguing that you're on the hook for any ongoing charges when it says you can cancel at any time?
Well, it says there's a 14-day trial. If you choose to keep your trial, you'll be billed. You have to do it within 14 days.
But it doesn't say that.
That's how they react.
If I can clarify, it looks like there's two separate issues. There's this tooth whitener, and there's the health club fitness membership. And they're really two separate things that were bundled together in the purchase.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, what they told me was, and canceling the trial is not difficult. You do have to pursue it a little bit. The problem is you have to cancel the trial within 14 days, and it sounds to me, Senator Rosenbaum, like you're saying that it doesn't specifically say that.
I would read this as specifically saying the opposite of that. I mean, obviously I'm not a lawyer, but I'm married to one. But if you just read this, read what the fine print says. Nowhere in there does it say you can cancel at any time, but only during the 14-day trial period. It says in bold letters, no obligation, comma, cancel any time, exclamation point.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, so if somebody read that, they could even be misled that they could cancel at any time.
Absolutely.
And they wouldn't be charged.
That's what it says
but
to me.
What their practice is they charge it immediately after those 14 days. It's day 15 or 16 where they charge you for the month ahead. So it's really deceptive in two ways, and I hadn't noticed that. I appreciate that, Senator Rosenbaum.
Any other questions?
Well, thank you so much for your presentation.
You're entirely welcome, and I will be happy to sit in on your next work group meeting. I've done some research with the FTC, and where Oregon was one of the states that, in conjunction with several others, commented on this rule to the FTC. The comments were due last October, but I just checked last night, and there hasn't been any change to the rule. So I will be happy to work with you on that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. So the next item on our agenda is an update about the work groups on the free trial offers and debt collection. I'm going to do that if I can continue speaking. Cheyenne might need to help here. We've had three meetings. I'll start with the free trial work group. We've had three meetings with many participants representing many different interests, consumer groups as well as
many of the telecommunications companies, Direct Marketing Association. There's been a lot of good discussion. We did look at the Maine legislation that was passed recently. We believe that's the only state that has passed legislation on free trial offers. What we want to do is make sure that we are getting at the real problem, which is the type of thing that Ms. Garst explained, but not inhibiting legitimate offers from businesses. Sometimes that's a fine line to walk, but we're working hard on that. Actually, the representative of the Direct Marketing Association, who's coming in for the meetings from D.C., has been very helpful in that, and to use his phrase, we want to make sure we get the scoff laws, but not the legitimate companies. So we're basing some legislation on starting with the FTC rule, which basically everyone needs to comply with now because many of these companies do business nationally. And then we're adding provisions to make sure that that there's clear and conspicuous disclosure of all of the terms of a free trial offer. And also we're adding a provision that says that for the additional product or service, in this case it would have been the World Club Fitness, there has to be a separate affirmative consent by the consumer to that, and that also needs to be clearly and conspicuously disclosed. So that's the direction that we're going. We want to make sure that we have a sufficient remedy, so it would be a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to violate this clear and conspicuous disclosure and the requiring of affirmative consent. If anyone else who does not already know about that work group is interested in joining, please let Cheyenne know, and we'll let you know when our next meeting is, which is likely to be in mid-October. Excuse me. We've also been having work group meetings on debt collection issues. We have also had three meetings. We tend to do these back-to-back, the debt collection and the free trial work group meetings, because some of the participants are the same. We are focusing primarily on the practices of debt buyers. Debt buyers typically buy a large quantity of delinquent bills, and they tend to use some pretty questionable practices, and we are requiring in our proposed legislation that debt buyers have information in their possession about the account that they are seeking to collect, that they have that information and they can confirm it. If they file a lawsuit, they need to give a notice to the consumer, 30-day notice to the consumer before they file that lawsuit. And in their allegation, when they file the lawsuit against the consumer, they need to also allege that they have that information in their possession and can confirm the amount of the debt and late fees, etc. There are also some updates to the Fair Debt Collection, Oregon Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that we're working on that have been discussed in previous legislation that includes the attorney fee provision and the statutory damages. Again, if you're interested in participating in that work group and you're not already on the email list, please let Cheyenne know. Again, we expect that our next meeting will be sometime in mid-October. Our next agenda item is an update on the Homeowner Stabilization Program. We have Lou Savage from the Department of Consumer and Business Services and Rick Krager from Oregon Housing and Community Services here to talk about the update on the Homeowner Stabilization Program. We have heard testimony about this issue previously, but it's ever evolving and changing, and we're looking forward to getting an update from Lou and Rick. Welcome back.
Welcome. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lou Savage with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. DCBS participated with Oregon Housing and Community Services in developing the proposal, which was submitted and approved by the Treasury Department. And I'll just give you a little background, and then I'll turn it over to Rick, because his folks have really been doing the implementation and the heavy lifting once the proposal was accepted. In March, actually March 29th, Housing and Community Services learned that U.S. Treasury had allocated $88 million in TARP funds to Oregon. And Oregon was one of five states to receive these funds because of the high unemployment rate. the Treasury asked these states to develop programs that would prevent foreclosures and develop strategies to stabilize the housing markets. The timeline was very short. By the time we actually got the proposal, there was really only about 6 weeks to develop the program, seek input, and get the proposal to Treasury. There were a couple of requirements that needed to be met. One was that these TARP dollars could not go directly to state government. They had to go to an entity that met the definition of a financial institution under the TARP program. The programs that were to be developed were supposed to be designed to prevent foreclosures, protect home values, and provide for public accountability. And as I said, we really had only about 6 weeks to put this proposal together. We had a couple of challenges. One was to develop some data that we could use to put the program together. We collected and reviewed data about unemployment, changing housing values, foreclosures, and delinquencies. We also needed data to identify the areas of the state that would receive the substantial majority of the funding, which is what the proposal required. We also needed to actually design the program, and it was clear to us that we needed to go out into various areas of the state to talk to folks to see really what would work in particular areas of the state, because the situation in particular communities was not the same statewide. So we held four public meetings in Medford, Eugene, Bend, and Portland. And there was actually two meetings in each community. One was a meeting with community leaders, both public officials and other community leaders. And the second meeting was more of a public forum where we invited members of the public, homeowners, and interested folks who could give us good information about what was happening in their community. And as I said, there really was a distinct difference between what we heard in places like Medford and Bend and what we heard in Portland. But there was some common themes. People needed time and assistance to get back on their feet because these were folks who were recently unemployed or underemployed, and so there was a severe drop in their family income. The current HAMP modification program that was set up by the federal government was clearly not working for many folks. There were regions in the state where housing values had dramatically declined, particularly in Medford and Bend. We heard this from a number of folks. So homeowners were actually considering walking away from the homes that they had purchased. The families who could no longer afford their homes needed help to transition into affordable housing situations. And many individuals really did not know where to turn, and they didn't know what resources were available, and were really pretty much lost in terms of who they could turn to. We also met separately with counselors, housing counselors, advocates, and members of the financial community, both in person and on conference calls, to get input as to what kind of programs we ought to develop. And in retrospect, those community meetings and meetings with the counselors and financial industry folks were really critical in developing the programs. So I'm going to turn it over to Rick now to give you kind of an update as to what we finally submitted and where we're at with the program implementation.
Thanks, Lou. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and I appreciate the invitation today to come and present to you on where we're at with the hardest hit fund programs. When I last saw you, I think it was the week before our proposal was due, and as Lou described, we were kind of on a whirlwind six-week trying to put this proposal together and get it out. I'm happy to say that we did get the proposal put together on June 1st, and we're pleased with with what we were able to get accomplished. What I've provided staff has provided you this afternoon or this morning, is my written testimony along with I think the presentation that we gave to you last time as well as to the emergency board. And again, if you just need an update on the programs. In addition, we have a frequently asked question flyer that we've been using for a lot of our outreach and communication that answers a lot of the questions that consumers have had as well as the partners. So again, this is just information I wanted to make sure I left with you. And if, certainly if there, you have questions about that, I'm happy to answer. Just as a quick summary, and I think Lou did a very thorough job in terms of what we had gone through, just a quick reminder of the programs that we had submitted to the U.S. Treasury as consideration. I sort of describe it in three areas. First, we had a loan modification assistance program, which was really designed to put money to help many of the people that are currently in the system trying to get modification. I'm sure you've all heard that many people have struggled in terms of get HAMP modifications or get to a successful loan modification. And what we have discovered is that with some investment of the dollars, we can help those transactions actually be successful. So part of our proposal was to address people that were currently in the system struggling to get to a modification. The second piece was what I like to describe as more of a triage approach, and it was targeted towards individuals that are either currently unemployed or people that had severe economic distress, significant loss of income due to unemployment. And I call it the three-legged stool, where we would come in and provide mortgage assistance to the borrower to help get them back either current or paying their mortgage, and then work with them through counseling that we would fund to be able to help them get back on their feet, maybe get retrained, get some employment services. So it was designed to buy them some time to get back on their feet, and then at the end of that period of time of assistance, there were kind of two opportunities for them. One would be money set aside for them to help them perhaps do a principal pay down, get a reinstatement of their loan, get it caught up, back to a point where they've either become employed or regained stability and they need just some form of assistance that gets their mortgage back to a point that they can actually afford it. The other piece is that we recognize that maybe not everybody was going to be successful. Maybe they continued to be unemployed, and we needed to try to find a way to transition them into another affordable housing opportunity. So we had set money aside specifically for transitional assistance. So again, we envisioned those three programs kind of working together as a triage approach targeted towards unemployed individuals. The third area was what we called a refinancing acquisition pilot. And again, we heard, especially in Central Oregon and Southern Oregon, with the loss of housing values. I mean, it's been dramatic across the state, but certainly in those regions of the state, we've seen huge losses in the home values. And as like Lou said, many people are looking just to walk away from their housing. And we thought an innovative approach and something that's been happening in Sacramento is to look about negotiating with banks on short sales to be able to acquire those properties at what their current value is and then be able to work with another partner in trying to refinance that. And this was, I would say, the most innovative program that any of the states had actually proposed. I don't think any other states had put anything like this forward. So we wanted to, we looked to trial that in Deschutes and Jackson County. So those were kind of the three things that we had submitted. Again, like I said, on June 1st, it was submitted to the U.S. Treasury. We were told that it would be about a six-week process to review that. We were hopeful because we were the second wave of states that they would move quicker and that perhaps we would be, you know, we were optimistic that we, you know, could get approval and get going. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. I think we actually didn't start negotiating with the U.S. Treasury until about mid-July. Now, of course, once the negotiations started, they said, oh, by the way, we want to close this transaction in 2 weeks. So at that point, we were notified, okay, let's talk about your programs, let's start reviewing, and let's get everything put together and try to close this transaction, this $88 million transaction, in the next 2 weeks. Lou had mentioned part of this requirement is that there has to be, this money doesn't come to state government. It has to come to an organization that meets the definition of financial institution, yet they still want our agency, Housing Finance Agency, to be the administrative oversight and provide all the work. We had to actually get this organization set up, which is no easy task, but certainly it was something we were up for. And on July 29th, I'm happy to say we were able to create what we have entitled the Oregon Affordable Housing Assistance Corporation. So this was the entity designed to actually have the contract between Oregon and the U.S. Treasury. And then on August 4th, we did close the transaction. They approved four out of the five programs that I had mentioned. Now, the good news here is they gave us the entire $88 million. They said we're happy with it, but they were still not completely to the point of clarity on the refining acquisition pilot that I had described. But they did say, we want to get this transaction closed. We want to give you the $88 million. We're interested in this. Let's have further discussion, because within this particular program, there's a lot of flexibility to move the dollars around, because if one program doesn't work, we can reallocate to another. So that happened on August 4th. And then August 11th, we were notified, and again, good news, sort of a good news, bad news scenario, we were notified that the Treasury wanted to give another $49.3 million to the state, but they wanted it to be specifically for unemployment programs, in other words, the mortgage assistance. It wouldn't go to help any of those other programs I described, but it would be just plain out mortgage assistance that would be provided. So good news in that money was coming to the state. Bad news is that we'd already submitted one proposal based on $88 million. Now we have another $49.3 that we have to kind of figure out how it all works together. Based on everything that's kind of come at us, we still are standing strong with our implementation date that we had initially proposed, which is a December-January start time. Some of the major barriers, and barriers may be a little bit too strong, but some of the major challenges that we face in implementing this now $137 million program is, first, is administratively. This all has to be set up. There are systems that have to be in place. There are contractors that have to be in place. There has to be agreements worked out with banks, because this money has to flow through the bank. So there's a huge amount of administrative piece that we have to put together. There is no program like this currently set up to where you can just say, let's just dump it all in there and it could be administered that way. There are some states that had programs like this already set up, and it made it easier for them, but most of us are all in the same boat and trying to actually structure the administrative piece. So there's, we're in the process. We've gotten some positions hired. We're starting to develop the business process design, develop the relationships. So I don't want to call that a barrier, but it's certainly something that, because many people say, well, can't you just get the money out the door? And certainly we want to, but we have to actually have the controls put in place, because the Treasury is not going to let us go forward until they see those controls are there. The second thing is really responding to an ever-changing program. And I recognize that the U.S. Treasury is sort of under the gun right now to get these TARP monies allocated. They have essentially until October 3rd that they have to have signed contracts in place to get the TARP money put out. Again, we were told $88 million, develop an innovative program. We did that, and then all of a sudden they gave us another $49.3 with a whole different set of criteria, and we're trying to work this into a overall approach that makes sense for Oregon. So that has been a challenge, because we were going one direction, and now we're looking at some different types of approaches. The third thing, and I think this is really important, and this is what makes this program so unique. These, again, are not dollars that you directly spend out to borrowers. It has to be working in conjunction with banks. And there are six major servicers that hold the majority of Oregon portfolio. And many of them have said, we're happy to work with these housing finance agencies on these programs, but we're not going to do 10 different programs with these 10 different states. We want one type of program that looks like this. So as I'm speaking right now, my program administrator is in Washington, D.C., negotiating with those six major servicers to see if there is a program that they will accept and that will work for them. Again, that's good news in that we can make this more efficient and get the money out the door to the people that need it. The bad news is that, you know, most of them seem interested in primarily a mortgage assistance type program. Nobody shows a lot of interest in principal reduction and trying to get people actually modified. And so we had one major bank that has expressed interest, Bank of America, and they've been very good in working with. But the rest of them have pretty much said, you know, principal reduction isn't necessarily a program that we're interested in. So that kind of leaves us in the situation where we've said, okay, this is the way we want to go, but you don't have the banks willing to play. So we may be looking at having to shift and reallocate and essentially make this more of a mortgage assistance type payment to give people time, provide them the services to help them get back on their feet. But unfortunately, I don't know if I'm going to have an answer at the end of that assistance to be able to help them, because again, I require the bank to really work with us on that.
Mr. Krieger, who are the other five? You said there were six majors.
Yeah, there's Bank of America, Citi, Chase, Wells Fargo, GMAC, and there is another one that is unique, and I will, Madam Chair, if I could get back to you on that, it's PNC, I believe, but I'll get back to you on that to make sure, but those four, five are for sure, and those are the ones that we're negotiating with right now. So again, I would say the most significant barrier is trying to work this program so that the banks agree, because we have to partner with them and the money has to flow down to the banks, and getting them to a point of working with us. So I think the last thing, and again, I don't know if I want to describe this as a barrier, but certainly, and I think you all recognize this, there is a huge need in this state. There's a huge need in this nation. This is a significant problem that we're facing. The foreclosures and delinquencies that we saw were, you know, close to 50,000 last check. I mean, this program alone, at least initially targeting, was only going to serve about 8,000 households. So, and again, you know, that was based on the structure that we had laid out. If that structure gets adjusted, it may change the numbers a little bit. So there's a huge need. And, you know, we're doing everything we can to outreach to our community partners, to outreach to the public. We've established a website for everyone to access. You see the frequently asked questions that we're providing to our partners to make sure they're distributing to individuals. As we get calls, and we're getting a lot of them, we have a toll-free number that's coming in. We're giving people information about where we're at, when they can expect services. But certainly there is just a huge, huge need out there, and we are doing everything we can to get this in place as soon as possible. Having said all this, I don't want to just paint this as, you know, there's all these barriers. I feel very confident we're going to overcome this. We're going to have some programs in the state that provides the assistance that people need. And again, I would forecast that to be still around the November, December, January time. But again, despite all the challenges, we have been able to get the organization set up that can actually accept the money. We've closed the $88 million transaction. We're scheduled to close the additional $49 million here this week. So that money will all be secured for the state. We've built some very positive relationship with both our lenders and our consumer advocates, working very strategically with them. We've begun hiring our core administrative team. There's a lot of people that we need to be able to develop business processes and loan officers, so we begin hiring that core administrative team. I've already mentioned we've completed the website, and we have this growing email list to keep people informed. We've participated in several legislative town halls, and we're happy to continue to do that, to give people information. We've gotten extremely strong interest from our congressional delegation, Senator Merkley's office we've been working with, to actually the innovative idea that I was telling you about, which is still there, and we're working with the U.S. Treasury. They're getting significant interest at a national level on that type of program, so Senator Merkley is really helping us in terms of trying to get that off the ground. And so, again, I I just wanted to leave you with some of the things that we have been able to accomplish to this point. So, Madam Chair, that is my quick presentation overview. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for all of the work that you've been doing on this obviously very important issue. We, as legislators, have been hearing, I know I probably speak for all of my colleagues from constituents who are facing foreclosure, and will this website be helpful to them now? I mean, typically I've been referring people to the SafeNet.
Yes. So, I think, Madam Chair, you should continue to provide them to the SafeNet, because that will simply, at that point, will give them information on things that they can be doing now. The one message that we continue to tell people is don't, if you need help now, go to the SafeNet line. Don't just wait for this particular program, because we've been very upfront from the beginning that this was going to be an end of the year program from implementation. So I think, though, the website that we have put in will provide them information on where we're at in terms of developing these programs, what could be offered to them down the road. So it's meant to be informational to those that need help.
Thank you. Senator Dries.
Actually, I have two questions. The first one has to do with the Housing Distressed Index. Could you give me the formula that's calculated on?
Sure. In terms of looking at the Housing Distressed Index, what we did, and I think Lou had mentioned that we had provided, gotten a lot of feedback from folks around the state. And as we went through, that was one of the questions, you know, in terms of how do you determine economic distress, because that's one of the things that the U.S. Treasury wanted us to do. Look at the entire state and you tell us where you feel the substantial majority of the funds should go. So what we heard was, you know, obviously unemployment is a big piece to what is to be considered. But the other thing is that people wanted a recognition of how things have changed, especially in the last 2 years. We've seen huge increases, huge unemployment. So that should be a factor. So change in unemployment, total unemployment. Obviously, what is the foreclosures and delinquency rates in communities? What are you seeing in terms of percentage of foreclosure delinquencies? Where are the biggest problems? And finally, the fourth factor being the change in housing value. So those are basically, I'd probably need to get my research guy to kind of give you all the detailed formula, but it's essentially an average of all those things to come up with an economic distress factor.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Go ahead.
I'd like the equation, because
sure.
Because there's some of them have, like some counties have zero foreclosures. I've cut back to several of them, and yet they have a housing distress index. So it can't be a straight multiplication. And that, I'm having a hard time trying to calculate in my head how, you know, you weigh that. And that's kind of, I just want to make sure that it's done equitably.
Yes, absolutely. And Senator, I would be happy to give you that. I'm not too much of a mathematician, but I will certainly get that actual calculation for you to see exactly how that came up.
Okay, the second thing, and this is the TARP money.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm a cynic, but I am. I have free money from the feds is rarely free. And what strings are attached with this money, and what implications do we have that might cost us money down the road by implementing these programs?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I appreciate that, and certainly federal money, I know that we've all seen it doesn't come with, I mean, there's certainly strings attached. I mean, one of the requirements is obviously that we have to work, as I mentioned, through the banks, and dollars have to be pretty much, I can't spend the dollars directly to borrowers. It has to be through their banks. It has to be negotiated with their bank. There has to be agreement in place. So that, to me, is one of the biggest challenges that we face, again, because you have that third party you're going to have to work with. Having said that, I will say that in my 20-plus years of experience in working with federal agencies, this one actually has been much easier to work with the most federal agency. They have allowed the HFA a lot of innovation and creativity in terms of designing these programs. They do have a list of accountability stuff in terms of readiness to proceed, reporting that we have to do that's quite detailed. And certainly we have built that into our administrative budget. The one thing I want to assure you, and I assure the emergency board, is that we were very clear that we couldn't take, this state couldn't take on something where general fund was going to be asked to pick it up. So the dollars here are flexible enough to build an administrative budget. So everything that we have to do is built in there.
Senator Rosenbaum had a question, and then Senator Dredd. Or excuse me, Senator Dredd.
Do you have another follow-up? I think I'll let some other people, and I might come back.
Senator Rosenbaum?
So I think it's great that we're getting this money, because clearly we have a huge problem in Oregon. I mean, we always knew we were behind the curve. You know, I can remember back to 2007 when we were fighting about making changes to our foreclosure laws then, and people were testifying there's no problem in Oregon. Well, now I don't think anybody would come in here and say there's no problem in Oregon. All you have to do is look at these figures. I have a couple of questions, though, about how this is working, and they come partly from having read the big Oregonian story that was in the Sunday Oregonian. Did either of you see it? It looks like, Rick, you did not. And so the gist of this story is sort of a lot of testimony that has been given to this committee previously, which is people are having enormous frustration and trouble actually getting mortgage modifications from their lender. And it goes to that people are going so far as to file lawsuits in federal court representing themselves pro se without a lawyer, and actually succeeding in some cases doing that. And I think, you know, not to ask too long-winded a question, but when we had the Bankers Association here at a previous hearing and I asked, what would you do if somebody in your family was facing foreclosure, their answer was, get a really good lawyer. But as you know, the problem is there aren't a lot of lawyers doing this kind of work, certainly not for free. And so I guess my question is really about the Loan Modification Assistance Program. Mm-hmm. Because people are telling these stories, and they were documented in the Sunday paper, of the same kind of testimony we've heard over and over, that they've done everything they're told to do. And then they're told documents weren't received. And then they're asked for a different set of documents, and they fill all those out and send them in. Then they get somebody else on the phone who also didn't receive those documents. Meanwhile, some of these people are veterans. They're moving toward being out in the street, and they're at their wit's end. So does that particular program or the person answering the 1-800 SafeNet phone number have the ability to do something for these people that won't require them to just join these class action lawsuits?
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I think you summed it up extraordinarily well in terms of the frustration that borrowers are having with the existing loan modification. It simply has been a nightmare for them to navigate through the system. And so one of the things that we heard throughout our discussions around the state is, you know, number one, from borrowers is, you know, help us navigate, you know, what assistance, what money can be put into helping provide us some assistance and guidance. So one of the things, and it's not mentioned here because it's not seen by the Treasury as a program, but there are dollars that we have set aside specifically for counseling and assistance to help people navigate through that system. We are looking currently at our regional housing center as a source for providing that. In addition, one of the things that we heard a lot was the need to, if possible, to fund legal aid assistance. We researched that and we pushed on that, and basically, and back to one of the things that Senator Girard asked in terms of flexibility that this is one thing they didn't get on. They would not provide, they would not allow states to use the TARP money for any kind of legal assistance. So that completely fell off the table. But we did, again, ensure that there was money put there to assist the borrowers. The loan modification piece that I had mentioned, that money in that program is specifically designed to provide some additional assistance to that individual that you just described that's currently struggling, that can't get to a HAMP modification. So if there is some investment that can be provided, because of what we've heard from many of the servicers is that there are, and again, there's a lot of detail in terms of net present value calculations, things that qualify people to get to HAMP modification, but with small amounts of investments, you would be able to get someone to a successful and affordable modification. So that's our desire with the loan modification. Our current status with that, we've had a lot of conversation with Chase as one of the key servicers in terms of making this, and they're very interested in working with us to see if we can to make that program fly. So,
and Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I just would echo Rick's comment about the housing counselors. They are very overwhelmed, but to the extent that your constituent can get to a housing counselor, they are very adept at working through the maze of a financial institution. They're not always successful, but they're much more successful than a constituent doing it on their own. I know that Housing and Community Services has been making real efforts to get more funding out the door to those counseling centers.
Well, just a follow-up comment, Madam Chair, that to the extent this program will be successful, the metric or measure of it will be the number of real Oregonian homeowners who are able to stay in their homes.
Right.
And I think that should be obvious. There's no other way to measure success. And unfortunately, to date, most other programs that have been set up in terms of absolute numbers have not produced results in the number that we need. And so when we have this massive problem in Oregon, we need to see real people that are being able to stay where they live and afford to do so. And I think, you know, this is great and what you're setting up is great, but I also think there are things that other states are doing that actually do involve things like courts and oversight by judges who are specifically charged sure. with approving mortgage modifications that would be the teeth of a program like this to make it really work. And I hope that that's the kind of thing that we can be thinking about, because it just, you really should read that story in the Oregonian. It's truly eye-opening and heartbreaking when you see what's going on out there. I mean, you probably know a lot of this stuff already, but it's just not going to work unless there is some sort of stick to go along with the carrot of this money. So.
And I know Lou yeah. wants to respond, yeah. but let me just interject that we had many of these discussions during the 2009 session when we were negotiating Senate Bill 628, because Oregon, as you know, does not have judicial foreclosures. Many other states do. And so in a time, in a session when we were cutting budgets to add an entire new judicial program to require that all judicial, that Oregon switched to a judicial foreclosure state was just something that we could not do in that session. But I certainly appreciate all of your comments.
Madam Chair, that was going to be my comment as well. There was a time when judicial foreclosures were much more frequent in Oregon, and in fact, the court viewed itself as a court of equity and could get involved in the process. There are very few judicial foreclosures. I think probably over 90% of residential foreclosures are by trust deeds. So the homeowner actually has to take an affirmative step to get into court, and even then, it's not the sort of judicial oversight that occurs in a lot of other states. There would really have to be a very significant change in Oregon law to accomplish what you're seeking. And it's certainly, I agree with what you're saying, but at this point, we don't have the tools to do that.
I serve also on the Justice Systems Revenue Work Group, and the courts are strapped right now. But I appreciate it. And
it is interesting that the lawsuits referred to in the story in the Sunday paper are in federal court, not state court.
Right.
So I'm not sure what what laws they're using, but they're apparently prevailing in a lot of those cases. So
I'm not sure either, but I know at least, I believe that at least one of the consumers who was discussed in that story was talking about the approach that we actually very briefly considered in an amendment in February that actually Representative Richardson brought forward, and that would be to require that the entity that's foreclosing actually prove the chain of title and show that they were the real party of interest in showing the title. That's a pretty dramatic change, and I think that people have been using that as a defense to foreclosure, but it isn't in our Oregon statutes.
Senator George had a question, and then Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I obviously found it humorous when you guys talked about the fact that the financial institutions are unwilling to talk about the principles, because in essence, from my perspective, that's what this comes down to. We have a bubble in real estate, and this chart you gave us here about the median income, mm-hmm. even if the housing prices dropped where they are, Oregonians still can't afford the housing prices at the price we're at today, even with the drop, which means that what we've done in the system is we, through easy credit and through these different things, people who could not afford houses bought houses they couldn't afford, meaning they could afford the monthly payment maybe for a short period of time, but they can't actually afford the $400,000 house they bought. So what you have is, I mean, let me take it back. For 1 month in my life, I sold cars in California. And the training they gave me was hilarious because I was supposed to get the consumer in the room and get them to tell me how much they could afford per month. And I kept saying to my bosses, that doesn't make any sense because the question is, can they afford the car? And they kept saying to me, all we'll do is change the terms of the contract. We'll take it to 72 months, we'll change the interest rate, and we'll make them so they can afford it per month. What we're talking about here is what consumers can afford per month. But really, there's a lot of consumers out there who can't still afford the house no matter what. And the other problem we have, I was watching on CNBC or Bloomberg, one of those, something similar to what you guys were talking about with this housing distress index. They were talking about the shadow inventory of houses that are not on the market, either from banks or banks aren't foreclosing. Like, the banks are just letting them sit in land, and the homeowners are not paying their bill because they don't want to put that inventory on the market because the housing prices will drop so much. So here's the problem that I see. If we allow people to modify loans, what we're seeing is those people who modify loans are defaulting. And then if we kick the can a year down the road, so we give somebody assistance for a year down the road, and they still can't afford the house, we're in trouble. So what happens is that their unemployment benefits run out, then this mortgage payment assistance program, which is really just money cashed directly to the bank. I mean, all we're doing is bribing the bank not to foreclose on their house. And so it seems like to me that the only way we're really going to be able to get at this is if banks eventually say, you know what, we loaned a ton of money on a house that was nowhere near that value, and that we start addressing the real problem, which is the last one that you gave here, Rick, which is what is the value of the home, and can this the real value of this home, and can this person afford it, and then who's going to take that loss? And from my perspective is that the bank has a choice. We can let the person get foreclosed on, and they can take the loss, or they can take the loss and keep the person in the home. I mean, at some point, the financial institutions and their shareholders are going to have to realize that they loaned on false assets. And so what I'm concerned about is we take this $120 million or so, and we put it through the system, and we kind of keep the bubble kind of floating there. Mm-hmm. But at some point a year from now, when all that stops, the housing prices are going to drop, and people are going to be another year older. Their credit's going to be that much worse off. And then we're going to have housing prices that are going to drop, and more people are going to be in this trouble, but we don't have it, really even have fewer tools to be able to deal with it. And to me, your last one, your pilot project that you talked about, mm-hmm. I mean, the Treasury is going to have to recognize that you can't keep this bubble floating, and what you're going to do is destroy people's lives if we don't start saying these houses are not worth $400,000, they're worth $220,000. And I'll just tell you, because my wife and I own two rentals, our rental income continues to go down. Because what's happening is housing prices are going down, rental prices are going down, which means that the real value of real estate in Oregon is going down too. Because ultimately, assets are only worth what you can get as a rate of return. So from my perspective, I think what you guys said was dead on. At some point, the financial institutions are going to have to recognize somebody's taking a loss for this. And we can kick this can down. I mean, we can keep giving money to the banks, right? But ultimately, at the end of the day, the consumer is the one that's going to suffer. And I really applaud you guys for going after that pilot project. But at some point, we're going to destroy people if we continue down this pathway.
Well, Chair Bonamici, Senator George, that's why the outreach that we did was so important, because when we went to Bend and Medford, we really heard exactly what you were talking about. And I think Housing and Community Services' goal is to look at those communities first with that last program, because you can really kind of see a concentrated problem of housing values going down. I mean, the rest of the state has that problem as well, but it's really a kind of a test tube kind of case for looking to see whether a program like that would work.
And Madam Chair, Senator George, thank you for that. And I agree with you that, you know, the pilot program is very exciting, and I think it is a real opportunity to put a program out there that can be effective. To your you know, when we thought about the triage approach in terms of the mortgage assistance, one of the things that was key for us is can we get, you know, we need to make an investment to help people, but we also need to ensure that there is a sustainable mortgage long term. And we have to put the kind of underwriting terms on there that is absolutely affordable. Many banks look at front-end ratios in terms of, you know, can they afford that? But there is no looking at the back-end ratio.
Because they're selling it.
What about the credit card debt? What about all of the other things that factor into someone's ability to make their mortgage payment? And if you look into our criteria, is that we have to look at those back-end ratios. We don't want to get in that situation where we provide 12 months of mortgage assistance, and perhaps we are able to modify, and then 2 years from now they foreclose. We have to have sustainable mortgage. And you're right. The only way you're going to get to that point is some form of agreement of principal reduction to a point of what the value is can be, which, again, is unfortunate. I'm not getting any cooperation there. But the pilot program is maybe another approach that we can take to get there.
And maybe it's the optimist in me, but at some point I like to see unemployment decreasing and home values going up again.
I'll tell you, I think the only thing that's going to save that is inflation. So if we get inflation, if you start printing money, we'll be okay. We'll get the housing prices up there. But at this point, I look at the numbers, and especially this chart right here, Madam Chair, this chart right here.
Right.
So if you take the average family of three, which is their median income is $55,000, what size house can they afford?
Right.
I mean, maybe a $160,000 house.
This is off the top of my head, but I would say from a ratio standpoint, probably about $150,000 to $200,000 home.
Yeah, and so you're talking about homes are at least, I mean, just taking groups, at least $70,000 in that range. $70,000 still overpriced right now today. That's just a crisis waiting to happen 2 years from now.
Madam Chair, Senator George, one of the responsibilities that the housing counselor has when we get this program up and going is to do that kind of assessment, mm-hmm. so that we don't put people in programs where they're not going to succeed.
Thank you.
That's helpful. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concerns are very much along the same lines. I think, you know, because we had a housing bubble, people lied on their loans, the banks were sloppy, so people were put into houses that they couldn't afford, they could never afford, and it's just like the car dealership, they kind of, you know, manipulated things around so it looked like so it was all based on fantasy. And so now the piper's coming to call. So I'm wondering if there's any thought given to, you know, these people who are in these homes, they can't afford these homes. These homes are too big. These homes are too fancy. I mean, there are people, you know, I see people who I know live in far fancier homes than I live in who can't afford them. Mm-hmm. And so is there any thought given, any creative thought given to trying to somehow not just manipulate the mortgage to subsidize this house that they never can afford and never will be able to, and to somehow get them into a house that they actually can afford. Because I think that's, you know, I look at it, you know, not from the global standpoint, but from the standpoint of the families, the actual families involved, many of which have children, who are actually at risk of being out on the streets or in complete disarray. Is anyone given thought to having some orderly process to getting somebody out of a 4,000 square foot home and into a 1,500 square foot home?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, yes, and I think I heard Senator Rosenbaum talk earlier in terms of the success being ensuring that people are able to stay in their home, and certainly that is one part of what we're trying to do is ensure that people are able to stay in their home. If you look at sort of the intent of the program is, you know, how do we prevent foreclosure from happening? And ultimately for us, preventing that foreclosure and ensuring that that person has an affordable home to live in.
But not necessarily that.
Not exactly that home. So we talked a lot about, you know, providing some mortgage assistance and moving to a point where you could get that home in a place that they could afford it. But let's be honest, and just like you said, not every situation is going to go down that track. There are going to be times where a counselor looks at this and says, you know, you're not going to be able to afford this, even if you're able to get, you know, unemployment. You're not, with your ratios and where you're at right now, it's not going to work. So that's why we designed the transitional piece, so that's flexible enough to be able to help that borrower get out of that situation and get into something they can afford. Maybe it is another homeownership opportunity. Maybe it's a rental opportunity. But we've built the program flexible enough so that we can meet, you know, any of their needs. So, again, I see two tracks. There's the track where you're able to sustain that mortgage and they're able to maintain their homeownership, but there's also the track where you might need to move them into another living situation.
Good.
That's an affordable living situation.
Yeah, and I'm really glad to hear that, and I'm glad that, because I know I've worked with you a lot on the affordable housing issue in general, and I think this is really an adjunct of that, and we're talking about real people.
And Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, that's where we really feel like for our agency we have some opportunity, because, I mean, we have our affordable housing development portfolio. This is where we can develop some more linkages between our existing programs that we have normally run as, you know, as a state agency and this particular program.
Further questions? Do we have Senator Jerome?
Oh. Thank you, Chair. I would just like to say that I am a firm believer in the free market. And we've heard a lot of doom and gloom as far as the people that have been displaced and the people that have lost their homes. Very heartfelt and very, very true. The thing is about a correction is, if we look at the new people coming on, the people just coming out of college, the person that's just entering the job market, the person that's just starting out, they now can buy a home, whereas before they couldn't. The prices were so extreme that they just couldn't buy it. So there are good things to corrections in the sense that the younger generation actually benefits from the correction. The older generation pays the price for it. But in our case, being part of the older generation, a lot of that basis of real estate was, as Senator George pointed out, it was kind of a false price, and the fact is that it was boosted by subprime loans and et cetera, and the bundling of those subprime loans. So what I would like to, the question that I have goes back to the $88 million and the $49 million, and what kind of timeline are we looking at for the administration of that money? And again, I'm kind of concerned about the cost and the increase to DCBS, which is part of the all funds budget. And I know it's not part of the general fund budget, but I think that if you're looking at what we can afford and what we can't afford the government that we have statewide right now. And I think that to the business community and to job creation is probably the biggest detriment to the housing market that we have in this state. So I think we need to get the price of government down to what we can afford so that we can create the jobs that we need to create the income that we need to afford the mortgage, which is, to me, getting to the point where it should be. So just if you would like to comment, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, just
in terms of the DCBS issue, there is no cost to DCBS. There's no allocation of funds. The only time at this point that we've devoted to it is the time that I serve talking to Rick and being involved in some meetings, but there's really no allocation at all. And I guess the second, and I appreciate your comment about the market. One aspect of the foreclosure crisis is that it not only impacts the individual family, but it also impacts neighborhoods. And so there can be a spiral effect, so that and one of the things we certainly heard when we were in Bend and Medford and Portland as well is that if there's a neighborhood where there's some foreclosures happening, it impacts the whole community. So and I think Rick's folks have done a good job identifying how the programs can really help to support the neighborhood, not just the individual family that's impacted by the foreclosure.
And Madam Chair, Senator Girard, what I would say to your question, you asked about the window of time in terms of this program, what we have projected and forecasted and built into our administrative budget for these dollars is about a 3-year window in terms of the time it will take to get all the programs running, money out the door. Of course, there's monitoring and everything associated with that. So we see we've built about a 3-year budget.
Did you have another question, Senator Rosenberg?
Yeah, if we have time. I think we only have one more item on the agenda.
We do.
So I wanted to just ask a little more about the pilot and how that would work if it is approved. So would it be the 501c3 that would actually be purchasing these homes and then working with a lender to refinance them for the homeowner, or how would that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, excellent question. I'm always excited to talk about the pilot because, again, we've been recognized as having one of the more innovative designs of the other 10 programs. We've already done this, and I failed to mention this in my presentation. We've done already RFQ to get information from entities out there that could maybe provide that technical assistance to facilitate the transaction. At least the way we're thinking about it right now, is that there are some organizations and even some here in Oregon that have successfully done this in Sacramento, to where they are the party or entity that goes and identifies and works with the banks to say, okay, do we have any locations here in this county where we have someone that's in delinquency or foreclosure? So that's the first question. Then working with the bank to discover, you know, okay, what can we do here? Our goal here is to keep this person into their mortgage, but we're going to have to, you know, can we negotiate something where we can buy you out? So I'm basically working with this entity to... I would have the dollars available to purchase that loan, but they would be the one to go and work with the bank to actually negotiate it, get it to a point, underwrite it to a point where it could be affordable for that family, and then take it off their hands. Now, the way we initially envisioned this was that the money would be used as an interim pool of dollars that, you know, if you're the bank, I've just taken it off your hands for the value of that home, if I'm able to negotiate that with you. Then I would be working with a new lender to work through a different program to refinance that particular loan, and that would essentially revolve the dollars back to us to be able to do another transaction. Now, that's the way we initially envisioned it. Now, I mentioned Senator Merkley's office and working with them. They've already started negotiations and with FHA and with Bank of America to be able to pilot this program to where FHA is willing, because they've come up with a new program that allows financing for these type of situations. So they're looking to already be the takeout lender if you're able to negotiate within their standards. So I could maybe get to a point where we could do more and bypass the whole interim piece and be able to go negotiate a direct transaction with a new lender. That would be the ultimate, because I could save the money to be able to use for other types of things. there are going to be situations where perhaps you have someone that's in a home, it's way underwater, you're able to negotiate to a point of the value, and perhaps they need some credit counseling, or maybe there are some things that need to be done to get them more stabilized. So you might want to use that interim approach to have our entity that we contract with to hold the note with them for interim time to the point they're able to be successful. Haven't got quite that far in terms of those standards, but we just got the response from the RFQ, so we have an organization that is looking to work with us, would like to work with us, and we're going to be talking to the U.S. Treasury with them. So it's pretty exciting.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, because there are, and I know there's a representative of the realtors sitting in the room, but there are real estate companies in Oregon that are sending people out now to try to do short sales for existing homeowners who are in jeopardy of wrecking their credit and being foreclosed. And, I mean, a short sale is something different from what you're talking about, because I think in a short sale, that homeowner would have to leave that home. But they wouldn't have been foreclosed, right. And then somebody else would have to buy it. But in some sense, it is sort of, these are two different means of trying to get those homes basically costed at what they really are valued at on the current market, which means what somebody else is willing to pay for them.
Yeah, and certainly that's one goal, but obviously the other one is to, you know, if the family is in a situation to be able to afford that mortgage at the current value, our intent is to try to keep that family in their home.
Senator George.
I want to follow up on what Senator Rosenbaum just was talking about. This pilot project program that you're working on, Rick, really seems to me to address the fundamental issues and kind of gives us a pathway maybe out of where we're going or where we are. These other things, to me, perpetuate the problem. This innovative approach that you guys have developed is really kind of got me a lot more thinking about how it is. It seems like to me that we have a couple issues. We have banks that underwrote these loans. We have consumers who, in essence, probably lied or whatever to stretch themselves to get into houses they couldn't afford. Then you have banks that were complicit in that and went along with it. And so now we've raised all the value of these houses well above what they're worth. So, seems like to me, on a pilot project like this, the biggest problem we have is that what is the fair market value of something right now, right? When they came in, reappraised my house the other day for my refi, if somebody would have offered me that price, I would have sold it right that day. I mean, it was ridiculous what they appraised my house at, because I know it's well above the market, right? So they allowed me to refinance my house, and the appraisal was ridiculous, high. So the way I look at it is that it's interesting to me with this pilot project. What we're really trying to do is find out what the fair market value on a fire sale would be on that house. And it seems like to me that the problem we have with the banks is they're not willing to modify or negotiate with the current homeowner in modifying the loan, because at the end of the day they'll get the house back and, you know, they'll be held whole or whatever. But is it this foreclosure sale? And this is what is interesting about this project to me. It seems like to me that if we could pre-qualify people who are about to have their houses foreclosed on and find out what, under real standards, they could get financing for. Okay? So you help them with mortgage assistance for a few months while they go through the process of figuring out what they could actually afford, what they could afford under traditional financing. Mm-hmm. Then, if they got last right of refusal on the foreclosure sale, on the sheriff's sale, on the steps of the courthouse, which means that I may be able to negotiate a house down to $200,000 with a bank, right? But if the bank got to the steps of the sheriff's sale and the best bid was $150,000, seems like to me my consumer should be able to buy that at $150,000. Do you see what I'm trying to say? In essence, what we're trying to do is right now, as long as we have these mortgage payment assistance programs and TARP money and these things, banks have no incentive to recognize the real market value of the assets they have in their portfolio. If we created a program that's kind of based off your pilot project, where our consumer got the last right of refusal on a sheriff's sale, that would add a great deal of incentive all the way through the process on a free, fair market, open market process. And what you'd see is you'd have consumers, if they can truly afford it, can stay in their home. you would have the real market price of houses be established, and banks would have to recognize they need to negotiate all through the process to avoid that hard date of the sheriff's sale to kick somebody out of their home. And I just want you to kind of keep pulling at this pilot project you have, because I think what you've got here is the nucleus to develop a program to really force everybody to the table and then to really give us a pathway out of this housing crisis in the state of Oregon. So those are just a couple more ideas that you can add to it.
Senator George, you better be careful. Rick's going to put you on the implementation.
Some great ideas. Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Did you want to respond?
I just wanted to say, Madam Chair, to Senator George, that that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to plant the seed there. And to the extent, and like I said, many of these things that we had envisioned initially are beginning to slip. And because we have the flexibility to move dollars around, we have the opportunity, if this program does take off like we think it can, to shift the money into that particular initiative. Okay. So,
thank you so much for your testimony. And in closing, I just want to comment. There have been a couple of remarks made about the consumers who have been dishonest or outright lied and complicit banks. And I understand that everybody agrees that certainly that has happened in some circumstances, but my understanding is that the majority of people are struggling not because they lied on their mortgage or because, maybe even because they got into a questionable loan. It's because they lost their job or their income was reduced. So I just don't want to leave the impression that we have this crisis because consumers lied and banks were complicit. I think it's much more complex than that. So thank you very much for your testimony. We're going to take just a brief break, about 3-4 minutes. Please don't go away. The next topic is going to be very interesting. We'll be back in
the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. Thank you for your patience. We are going to go into an informational meeting hearing on privacy and social networking sites, and we have some invited testimony from David Almond, who is currently with the Department of Administrative Services. I want to preface this presentation by stating that after the agenda was posted, I think Cheyenne received multiple communications from all over the country about what in the world were we doing. So I want to make it clear to all of those who, I'm sure there are a lot more people who are watching this virtually or on the Oregon channel or web streaming, I want to make it clear that we are not here to somehow or another bash or prohibit or inhibit social networking sites. However, what we're here to do is have a discussion about some of the consumer protection issues that come up with social networking. And so we have Mr. Almond here who has years of experience in this area, and I'm sure he'll spark some very interesting questions. And Mr. Almond, if you want to go ahead and tell us a little bit about your background and give your presentation.
Please. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yes, for the record, my name is David Almond, and today I'm here as a private citizen, not on any official capacity. And if I think you have a handout now, so if you go to the second page, I'll give you some of my background. I've been in the technology field for 30-plus years, and you can go light on the plus. It's not that many plus years, but 30-plus years. I've got background in several industries, oil and gas, financial services, aerospace, state and local government. Most recently, I was a CIO for the Oregon Department of Revenue, and currently I am leading the Office of Transformation for the Department of Administrative Services. So my technology background goes back to the mid-70s, so I've been in this field for a long, long time. And let me lay out some personal biases. I think it's always good to know biases. I am a technology proponent and supporter. I'm an early adopter, and in some cases people might say I'm a geek. I love technology. I'm passionate about it. I think it's a game changer. So I'm a strong supporter of it, but I've also been in this field long enough to know that you got to be cautious. The technology that we're seeing today in social media that's grown up, and I'll be talking a bit more about that in a few minutes, is the same engine that's really transformed our world and changed the Internet as we know it. We would not have the Internet if it wasn't for the same kind of technology, the very collaborative tools that allowed open source development, runs a lot of the servers and a lot of the technology that we now take for granted. Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, goes on and on and on. They all use that same technology. So it's been very beneficial to our society and our consumers. I've been strongly encouraging organizations to adopt the appropriate use of social technology. And I know recently the Department of Revenue has actually started Twittering and communicating with its taxpayers that way. I think that's a very positive move. I think other agencies that I know of have started to reach out to their constituents through social media. I think the other big bias that I bring is that the generational expectations are there. The millennials in the workforce are coming in, and they breathe this stuff. This isn't a nice to have. This is the way they think and operate. And even though I've been doing this for a number of years, I still need to be reminded of that. I have three grown daughters, and I think part of the reason I stay on top of technology is so that they can't fool me. It doesn't work very well. I still think they know more than I do. But I had an intern, two interns this summer, one from the U.S., one from China. And it was interesting to see their use of this technology and how it wasn't something that they had to struggle with. It just came as natural to them as you and I operate a telephone. And it was interesting to see, not only did they have this natural tendency, but it was apparent that a lot of the bounds that we might have, because we've seen a lot more, were not necessarily there. And it really brought to mind how this generation coming up, and even people who are relatively new, what might struggle with some of the questions they might have to ask around what's the appropriate use of this media. So with that, let's go to the third page, and you'll see a chart on there and also a reference. This is an interesting chart. I've been using the Internet for probably close to 20 years. I remember my first time using it was probably in the early 90s when I got my first cable connection to a home and started playing on the Internet. And we've seen a change. If you think back, for those of you who maybe have reached back that far, in the early 90s, we had a veil of anonymity, and I won't call it secrecy, but anonymity. You got on to the Internet, you had some name that you gave yourself or a moniker, you were in chat rooms, and really it was just behind this veil of this veil of anonymity, and you could converse and people could be honest and get to know you, but there wasn't a lot of concern about that. It was, they tended to be very closed. Well, that chart that you see on page 3 shows an evolution in a short 10-year span from 97 to 2006 about the number of social sites that are coming up. And what we're going from is this veil of anonymity to a digital presence and to a pervasive digital presence that not only is there in real time, but becomes part of a record. And you need to understand, and I think consumers need to understand, that they are developing a digital image. So there's a very interesting article attached, and if you would like more information, this is a scholarly article. It's well written, but does go into a lot more detail. But I thought it was a good chart to show the evolution from the early 6degrees.com, which is one of the first social networking or social media sites, up to some of the ones that we have today. And there's many on here, as I was looking through this, that I've never seen or heard of. So I'm sure in the 4 years since this was written, many, many more have surfaced. So if you go to the fourth page, these are really the issues that I think are relevant for this discussion. I polled several people that I know that have been in this business as well and have dealt with social media over the years, and this pretty much crystallizes the core issues. I see six of them. The first one is the terms of use. And at first I thought, is this really a big issue, until I saw the earlier testimony, and it is a big issue. Because it's so easy just to click through. When you sign up for any service, or you sign up to download software, or you do anything, you get this, please accept the terms of reference. You click it. Do you read it? I have to confess, I seldom read it. I think I'm going to become a little bit more aware of that, but do we read it? And if you do read it, do you have the ability to understand it? And I don't mean that as a knock on anyone's intelligence, but I think we saw that discussion earlier. Two people reading it had a different understanding of what rights that gave. So I think that kind of understanding is something, are we assuming that the average consumer would even understand some of the language that they're reading? The other thing I find is the frequency of change. And I think what even makes it more difficult is often I'm using this device, my iPhone, and I'll get a note that says, the terms and conditions have changed. Do you accept? You know, I'm sitting there, not driving, but I'm sitting there, and I will accept. I will accept. So I haven't read it. So I really don't know what the terms and conditions have changed. So how do we know? I mean, the vast majority are operating ethically. That's not the issue. But as we pointed out, it's those exceptions, and do you really understand what you're signing up for? And then who really represents the consumer's perspective in this? I mean, those terms of use, I'm sure, are built for the protection of the organization that's preparing them, which is a natural tendency. So who reviews them and gives the customer or the consumer perspective? I think another one is content ownership. Who owns the rights and what can be done with it? And that's a really interesting question these days, because I know I've heard mixed signals on that. I've actually read some of the terms of reference, and ownership rights can become confusing. Who really owns it? If I post a picture on a website, do I give up rights to the use and the distribution of that? I think most of the ones that I've found try to protect you as a consumer. But have you verified that? Is it possible that you might be on a site where you lose the ownership of that content? What about blogs? What about other media? Who owns that and what can they do with it? So I think, can they sell it? Even if you don't give up ownership rights, can the operator of that site do something with that data? Can it be shared? Can content be sold? Can it be mined? And I think these are questions that you need to be aware of, the potential use, before you divulge too much in these sites or give too much content away. I think another area is privacy settings and what I'll call technology literacy. A lot of the sites that I've come across, I would say virtually every one of them, does have some degree of privacy settings, but do people know how to use them? And do they understand the implications of the various settings? And Consumer Reports recently did a study on this and found that 25% of Facebook users don't use or aren't aware that there are privacy settings. Well, I look at the good news that 75% do, so let's look at the positive side. But still, it's a healthy proportion of people who may be putting themselves at risk unnecessarily. So the question on the privacy settings and technology literacy is, do people understand enough about how to take advantage of these and the appropriate settings? I have, in my personal situation, I've been using websites and had friends of mine who were deep in the security area ping me and say, you know, you might want to rethink this setting, and give me the good reasons why, and I jump in there and redo it. So even though I've been in this business a long time, there's still things I have to learn. So I feel like I'm a knowledgeable consumer, and I still feel that there's a lot that I need to learn about the appropriate use of these. I think probably of these six, the one that I think is the biggest issue for a lot of consumers coming up, especially younger people, is the digital presence that they're creating on the Internet. While I think we in government are used to public records and records retention and the fact that we're transparent, there's a parallel that's taking place in the Internet world, which is our ability to store vast amounts of data, but not only store it, but have tools that can go through and search and look for information and piece together a story about our lives. So, in effect, we build a record of our persona on the Internet. And for most of us, that's not a big issue, but there's anecdote after anecdote after anecdote of people that have lost jobs. They got mad at their boss, made a posting. Oops, I had friended my boss. I've lost my job. There are people that have put pictures when they were in states where you wouldn't want them to drive, only to find out that it got back to their employer. There are people who've applied for jobs and couldn't understand why they didn't get job interviews, because the employers were scanning social media sites. So we, although these are fun and there's an element of entertainment, at the same time, you build this image and this presence on the Internet. And although, you know, we've talked about some of these anecdotes and they're kind of humorous, they're kind of serious, this can be taken to another extent. If you think of some of the terms that I've come across, human flesh searching, which is prominent in some countries like China, where you have tools that reach out into the social media sites and pull everything they can about a person to build a profile, and those can be used for a variety of purposes. They can be used anywhere from dealing with corruption to destroying a reputation. So now we've got the situation where we've used these tools to express ourselves, to have sharing information with others, with friends, but we've also got tools now that can use that data and collect it. So that kind of goes on to this whole point that, are we building a virtual house? And I said with fuzzy walls. So when you think of your house, you invite certain people in that you trust, and you welcome into the home, and you might welcome into certain parts of your home and other parts of your home. But some of these social media tools build these fuzzy walls, and you don't really know who you're inviting into the whole house. So do you really understand who you're inviting in and how they're going to, what they're going to see and what they're going to be able to use? The fifth area then is the unintended uses or consequences. And what I mean by that is not that anything is necessarily nefarious. There are some criminal activity that uses social media sites to get information about you for criminal intent. And that's no different than any other aspect of human endeavor. But there are other areas where I don't think we've really understood that there are uses for social media sites. For example, hiring decisions, we've talked about that. What you say can become part of a record, and people can find it and find out how you're really feeling about it. If you've been making disparaging comments about an employer and you've applied for a job, you might be hurting your chances, even though you might have said it 5 years ago, and it might have been in a specific heat of the moment. I've heard stories of insurance companies looking at social media to help make decisions on whether to insure somebody. We've heard about law enforcement. A big use is law enforcement looking, sending out information to bring criminals. Now, we might say that's a good use, but you've got to be aware that any kind of activity can be used in ways that you didn't as the consumer intend. Debt collectors, I've heard stories about debt collectors. And as I mentioned, the criminal activity, there was a website, and I've been trying to find it, and unfortunately I haven't found it recently, where actually you would pull information off social websites to find out when you're not going to be home. so that you could, you were a prime candidate for robbery, for break and entry. So you put too much information on the website, and you could be exposing yourself to some unintended risks. So again, as consumers, do you really want to put your pictures of your vacation as you're traveling on the website and let it know, be known to everybody that you're not home? It's so easy to do, and it can be something that any one of us could do inadvertently in the spirit of the moment. And then finally, the sixth area is introduction of new functionality. Now, this can be offered with good intent, but who looks at it from the customer's perspective? And an example that recently came up is a function that Google had called Google Wave, which was the integration of email and social media in real time, and that particular functionality only lasted a few months. It just was either so far ahead of its time, or people couldn't figure out how to effectively use it, that it's had about a 4 or 5 month lifespan. It didn't last very long, but it did raise the issue: Do consumers have the technical fluency to always understand some of the changes that are being made to these websites, and what does that mean? So although we might have some social media, and there may be changes to functionality with good intent, all the best intent, for example, you know, sites that might let you know, let your friends know where you are at any given moment, good intent, but there could be people seeing that have malicious intent. And do you know enough about how to make sure that only the right people get that kind of information? So functionality can be introduced, and if you're not an alert consumer and you're not fully aware of the potential consequences, are you inviting some issues? So those are what I see as the major issues. As I started to say, I'm a strong proponent. I believe in the benefits of this, but I'm also very cautious, and have learned to be very careful. In 30 years in technology, I've seen how it can be used as a great benefit, but also has caused some great problems. And I think we saw one of those earlier today in the free trials, and how easy it is to click, 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 and before you know it, you've got this monthly charge on your bill that you're not aware of. So with that, I'll invite questions, comments.
Thank you so much. That was very interesting. I'm going to start with a question and preface it by saying I guess that my Facebook friend who posted on her Facebook that she was going on vacation but nobody should come over because she had a house sitter and her really mean big dogs were left at home probably was maybe a little bit more aware than some. But my question is about education efforts that are being made about you've mentioned technology literacy. Are students learning in high school classes or college classes? Where are they getting this information that they need to know to be a savvy user of technology?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I have a clean answer for that question. I haven't come across courses specifically, but I haven't searched them out, so they may be there and I just may not be aware of them. And I think that's the generation that's at most risk because they've adopted this without the life experience to know to be cautious in many cases and may not be receiving all the guidance. I know my Facebook account that I actually took a breather from for a while, I was obviously friends with my daughters, and sometimes I wish I wasn't, because you find out everything they're doing, and you know, you might not really want to know that. So, you know, I think it blurs boundaries that in the past you just respected. So I don't have a good answer, and I'm not sure that they're always aware, especially when they may have visited and they're out late, and they're not necessarily in the best judgment what they're posting on their books, on their Facebook or other devices.
And I have a question also about, you mentioned that the Department of Revenue twittering. What happens in that situation when there is a state or governmental entity using social media and then they get a public records request?
That's one of the challenges, and I think from what I understand, the social networks are working that issue. Some cases, what some organizations have done is kept track and downloaded, which can become onerous. That is one of the biggest challenges that I see, and I don't know that there's a ready answer for that. Most of the sites that I'm aware of have cooperated in trying to get information. Some cases, organizations have downloaded information and kept their records separately. That, to me, is one of the biggest issues that we're facing from the government, is because of our public records requirements, how do we take advantage of some of these sites?
Thank you. Senator Gerard had a question.
Yes, thank you. It's easy to see the problem. You know, I mean, it really truly is. Anybody that has any computer experience whatsoever knows the problem. The solution is a little bit tougher to come up with. And I think what the chair was saying is that education seems to be the first step and the key. And I don't know exactly how to put that out there, but that seems to be the only solution I can think of. Is there anything else you can come up with other than just trying to educate the consumer?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, I think that is exactly the right answer. It's education, and it's probably the responsibility of both, I think, government and consumer in consumer affairs, but also the social sites, the responsible social sites, I think, do take that seriously. But it's going to be an ongoing issue with as each generation comes through. I think some of the savviness will go down. I think my experience is in many cases the generations get very, very savvy on technology. I don't know that they have that savviness necessarily about how information can be used and how people can add, you know, put two and two together when they're on technology sites and come up with a story. So I think there's an ongoing education that is required, and I think it's a shared responsibility between government organizations and the private sector, the producers of this technology, to help educate and to make sure that there are protections in place.
Other questions?
I see a couple of people in the room who I want to make sure that I give you an opportunity. Jim Craven, who represents Tech America, and Andrea Meyer for the ACLU. Is there anything that you would like to add to this discussion?
You're just tweeting about the hearing, I think.
We've been twittering
all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven for Tech America. I wasn't planning to testify, but I just want to dovetail on that final comment. I didn't bring a bunch of stuff with me today, but we certainly can furnish some stuff to your committee administrator. There are a number of really proactive national organizations, some of them driven by members of mine, of the companies themselves, some driven by attorneys general organization. There's a lot of work being done out there on education. Several years ago, the education work was more on the criminality of the internet, how not to get ripped off, cyber crime, and those are still big issues, as you heard earlier today. And those may not be crimes, free trial offers, but they may be a little bit shady. But what's happened in the last couple of years is in recognizing all the issues that David brought to your attention, there's a number of really great websites that are doing that kind of consumer education, and I can pull together some of those and furnish them to you, so you can at your leisure go look at them and see what kind of messages are being put out there. It's enormous educational effort, and it is happening. Nothing ever happens fast enough, probably, but it is out there, and both, like I say, from the government side, from the various attorneys general. Even I know here in Oregon, there's stuff about safe internet surfing on the attorney general site, and then a number of industry kind of coalition sites that are out there.
That may be helpful. I mean, I don't think we need a lot, but maybe some key.
Well, maybe a list of links.
Key references.
A list of four or five links that people can look at if they care to see what's going on.
And that would be helpful for us when we have constituents who contact us with an issue or a problem too. So, Andrea.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to speak today briefly. I think we have certainly seen within the ACLU from the next generation that this is a very important issue, digital privacy and understanding. And as those who are lawyers know, the right to privacy is one of the few rights that alters over time based on what society's reasonable expectation is rather than something set in stone. So as the next generation may not fully understand the expectation of privacy that they do have at the moment and their use of technology and other forms of communication, how that begins to diminish that privacy, we will see that reflected in how the courts and how our society looks at what protections we have.
This is a priority issue for ACLU. We are, as I said, especially for the next generation, and we continue to look for opportunities. I think education is one of the keys. But also, as you recall, last session before this committee brought legislation forward about the driver's licenses and the codes on your driver's license, the barcode, and how while that originally was put on your driver's license by DMV for potential use in the future, it turned out indeed that they weren't using it, but it had the ability with the private sector to scan that for purposes of most frequently had been used bars, just to establish authentic ID and that you are 21. And folks might give up their ID for scanning purposes just to get in the door, get the contract open with the vendor for whatever purpose. But what we know is that without the safeguards in place, that can be used for third party. It's a value to the business to sell. It's a value that can communicate a lot of information about people. And we appreciated this, the 2009 legislature joining our efforts and supporting, putting some constraints on that, really ahead of the time. And I think that's a challenge with digital issues, is trying to get ahead of the curve. And we're finding where those legislative opportunities are, not to necessarily stop the intended purpose, but to put safeguards around for more of the unintended purposes that you saw. And we will continue to look for opportunities, particularly when it has to do with the expectations of privacy and marketing and third-party use and how folks can control that, but and not create the opportunities where that's a value at the front end, so that maybe we stop it by some legislation becoming a value, so that the business sector can do its business, the consumer can do its business, but we don't expand it to another business of marketing and sharing information that people presume and want treated privately. To remind you all, it was everything on your driver's license, including your height, your weight, things that, you know, some of us may not currently always tell the truth on our driver's license as it is.
No.
Well, it's 8 years old sometimes. I know. I was shocked to see what I had put down 8 years prior, some of my data. Anyway. Exactly. It's inspirational. So I appreciate ACL. You'll be happy to continue to play the role and look for opportunities both in education with other parts of the ACLU of Oregon and nationally, as well as in the legislature to provide those safeguards and to bring to your attention issues that we see as cutting edge on privacy.
Thank you so much. Are there other questions of the committee?
I would just like to say this is, I think, a really interesting topic. And the problem, I think, is really growing. And what I picture is some kid showing himself having a beer, being drunk at a party, which is commonly done, and then an employer down the road 10 years looking at that picture and saying, you know, maybe this isn't the type of person we want to employ. However, I don't blame the employer for looking. I just really, truly don't. I mean, if the kid puts it out there, then I think it's public information. And being a healthcare professional, we have HIPAA laws. To a large extent, I think those are somewhat of a joke these days, because I think any nurse anywhere can pull up something, and if they wanted to use that against you, they probably could. However, the laws are in place to specifically deal with the privacy issue within healthcare. So I find this topic extremely interesting, and I think it is a wave of the future, but it's going to be tough sled, and I just really think education is the start, and then we take it from there. But I would be interested in any other solutions that people can come up with.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Gerard, if I may answer. Also, we have laws in place that are not current enough to address current use. For instance, and I will use the term that's developed, sexting. So we have situations where young people do stupid things, maybe even take pictures of themselves and transmit them electronically. Well, that act may fall under old statutes that really did not contemplate that type of activity. Certainly, we may need a lot of education about how you do and don't use your cell phone and what information you might want to share with one friend when indeed that friend will then spread it. But do we criminalize it? These are questions and issues, and so we have to grapple, actually, as I'm thinking about, as you were making that comment, with current laws and the unintended consequences of the definitions of electronic transmissions and other things, and how we retain what the intentions of those laws were and honor that, while at the same time not creating a set of juvenile offenders where that really may not be the right thing that we should be doing for that occasion.
Madam Chair, Jim Craven again, just really a personal comment as the father of a couple of mid-20-somethings, so, which I think is great. The age of my daughters, 25 and 27, when they were still young, this stuff didn't exist, and they kind of matured, and as this stuff became, you know, prolific, they were already in college and beyond, and it's kind of beyond the point where, you know, you need to worry on a daily basis, though you still do. I think what none of us know right now is whether, you know, part of it, we're a bunch of older people here saying the kids don't know how to protect themselves. What we don't know yet, I think, is whether there really truly is a societal difference in expectations of privacy going on among our offspring who've grown up in this. And so we have to be, you know, both concerned but cautious in sort of observing this shift. Is it these kids, bad things could happen to them. We need to tell them what not to do. And a lot of them, you get the eye roll. I don't care. I mean, so there's a little bit of that going on that none of us up here quite understand because we're not the right age. But so there's some of that happening, and it's just going to be interesting to watch it proceed. And
I'll be certain that if we have a follow-up hearing, we invite some high school students or probably middle school students. I'm looking at the graph here of the sites, and it reminds me of the Live Journal was way back in the late 90s, and I have kids who are young adults, and I remember talking to them about, you've got to be kidding. Do you really want everybody to know everything about your life? Yeah? Well, it didn't matter. So there are expectations that I think are shifting. Hopefully they've matured out of that by now. Senator Girard, you had another
question. The last comment, I mean, it's just an example that the Greg Oden nude pictures, you know? I mean, here's a guy that sent something to his girlfriend and ended up, well, you know, I mean, having his picture shown to just about everybody in the state. So I think that kind of drives the point home, and it does raise some concerns. I mean, I kind of feel sorry for him. Maybe it helped his female fan base, but I'm not sure. But that sort of thing is just commonplace with kids, and I just really feel sorry for them, and it's driving the suicide rate for teenagers up through the roof. And so I think that is something that we do need to be concerned about. But I do see the only educational point being that in education. So.
Madam Chair, I can't resist because
you're looking at your.
I've been looking at Facebook the whole time we've been talking. Not really, but just two things. One is that there's a great story in the current Atlantic magazine, which is sort of a profile of Facebook, and a woman who's laid off from her job then sort of starts living her life on Facebook by just like, you know, that's what she does because she comes home at night, has a glass of wine, gets on Facebook, looks at what's going on in other people's lives, and I don't want to ruin it for you, but you're probably not going to see it unless you subscribe to this magazine. In the end, somebody she actually used to work with dies, and the way she finds out about it is a posting on Facebook. And it's sort of like, you know, God, that isn't what I expected to learn. And then the other thing I was going to just share, one of the funniest stories about Facebook, and this really goes to, I think, Jim, your comment about we're too old. To show that we're not too old, there was a story on National Public Radio that a mother friended all of her daughter's friends and then started making editorial comments on their Facebook pages about how they were living their lives. Like, you're pregnant. You shouldn't be smoking. I see that picture of you with a cigarette. Haven't you quit yet? And this daughter, who was like probably middle-aged herself, was going, Mom, these are my friends. You can't be doing that. And so she sort of made a rule. This was like she made a rule that you can make friends with my friends, but you can't post to them unless they
write to you first, because it really does become sort of this whole other virtual reality for a lot of people. And it's not just young people. I mean, it's really, I think, I don't know if everybody up here has a Facebook page, but I know a couple of people up here that do.
I have two.
I know somebody's dog that has a Facebook page up here.
That would be, I had nothing to do with that.
So, Senator, the daughter will rule for the parent? Boy, they grew up in a different generation.
I thought when I heard that, too, my dad wouldn't follow my rules at all.
What a funny feeling. That.
Well, I felt I have a Facebook account I use rarely, but I felt it appropriate that I do friend my now 85-year-old father, because if he could be savvy tech enough to have a Facebook page after my sister explained, don't put your whole birth date and your year and all that information on, that I indeed would friend him.
Well, I can tell that many interesting questions have been raised. The purpose of having this hearing today was to start the discussion, and I would like to continue it at some point. And hopefully we can all go back to our constituents more well-informed and our children or parents with some helpful information that will help them be savvy consumers. So thank
we
you very much.
We start a Facebook page for the Consumer Protection Committee.
I'll take that. Under advisement. Thank you for the suggestion, Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting, and we are adjourned.